ways. Ouch, I said, putting an arm around her shoulders. I know that was hard, but I'm proud of you. Andrea nodded.
And it certainly explains why your shower hall is so skimpy.
I didn't take anything. Jolene sniffed, wiping at her cheeks. I just left. This whole situation sucks now, but it's going to do you a lot of good in the long run. I'm sure Zeb will appreciate not having to live on the farm, I said, rubbing Jolene's back.
I've never understood why people pick Noah's Ark for a nursery theme anyway, Andrea said breezily, folding a tiny pair of socks.
Really? I snorted. I mean, who wants reminders of a natural disaster, literally of biblical proportions, on their baby's walls? What are you supposed to say? Oh, drowning sinners, isn't that precious? Jolene looked up at me through glassy eyes. You're weird. I hear that a lot. My concerned and vigilant friend's letters increased in frequency. Once a week, then twice a week. It was creepy, and they rarely varied from the theme of, Gabriel hurt me, he'll hurt you, he made promises to me, ruin me forever, you're a big fat idiot for trusting him. Okay, that last part was implied. One night, I sat at the shop counter, sorting through them as Dick sipped an Americano and read a Tales from the Dark Side comic. I tried to divide the letters into piles, based on threat level. But I kept getting the, I hate him, I love him, and he'll hurt you piles mixed up with the larger, I can make your life a living hell if you don't listen to me pile. I sighed and rubbed my eyes. There was also a disturbingly large pile of photos of yours truly taken with a telephoto lens. Frankly, it was at times like this that I missed Gabriel's overprotective caveman tendencies. Even if it insulted my feminist sensibilities, it was sort of nice knowing someone was out there watching my back. Going through this without him made me feel incredibly alone, even though I'd told Dick and Andrea. Going home alone each night, being unsure of what was waiting for me there, was weighing on my nerves. I muttered, "For a stalker, this chick is all over the place. She's angry and focused in one letter, and erotomanic the next. Or at least I'm assuming she's erotomanic for the sake of my pride." Dick's face was blank.
Erotomanic? That sounds sexy in a way that's not.
It means someone believes they're in a relationship with someone, but that person usually isn't aware that their so-called lover exists. You have your basic, I want to become famous by killing someone famous, fellas. And then there are the delusionals, the ones who think Ryan Seacrest is sending them secret love messages through the television. The most dangerous ones are the people who actually know you, whom you run across in your everyday routine because the people around you really don't know whether you're lying when you say you're not involved with your stalker. Hence my confusion. Gabriel could be the victim of a stalker, or he could be a plain old cheater. But since he's acting more like a cheater than a victim... What? I asked when I caught the befuddled expression on his face.
You read up on stalking?
I had someone paint blood-sucking whore on my car a year ago. It merited a Google.
I don't like it, Dick said, grimacing.
I think the very word stalking implies that you're not supposed to like it. Otherwise, it would be called fluffy, harmless observation time, I said, chewing my lip. And considering that this woman might be dangerous, I don't know whether to warn Gabriel, which would mean I would actually have to talk to him, or just let whatever's going to happen happen to him because a tiny part of me thinks he deserves it.
Well, you know my vote, Stretch, Dick said, turning his attention back to his comic.
I think the stalking talk made Dick uneasy because he didn't want to leave the shop that night until I was safely tucked in Big Bertha. But he had what he would only call special plans with Andrea, and I needed to stay late to go over some internet orders, so he had no choice. Around 1 a.m., I put the stacks of letters in my purse and headed out the rear staff entrance. As I pushed the key into the deadbolt, I saw a dark male shape reflected behind me in the glass. Even if I hadn't seen it, I would have felt him. My keenly developed sense of paranoia was a wide-open channel to the towering male presence. I snaked my hand into my purse and ran my fingers along the leather stun gun holster. I felt the body behind me advance, so I turned, whipping the stun gun out and proceeding to shock the ever-loving hell out of my ex-boyfriend.
Gah!
Gabriel screamed as the electric current shot through his body, dropping him to the concrete like a sack of potatoes.
What is wrong with you? I yelled as the current made his torso arch off the ground. I may or may not have held it to his chest a teensy bit longer than absolutely necessary.
Stop shocking me,
Gabriel grunted through chattering teeth. Sorry, I said, pulling the stun gun away to let it cool off.
Why do you have a stun gun?
He demanded, hefting himself off the ground. Because people have been sneaking up behind me, I said, glaring at him. Honestly, why would you surprise the most spastic person you know?
I knew you'd do something to avoid talking to me if you saw me coming,
he said, dusting himself off.
And what do you mean, people keep sneaking up behind you? Are you all right? Has someone been bothering you?
Yes, you. When you know someone will try to evade you if you try to talk to them, that's called a hint. You need to learn to interpret social cues. And sarcasm, but that's not exactly urgent to the situation at hand. Why are you here? I haven't heard from you for weeks, and you show up now? What do you want, Gabriel?
I miss you, he admitted.
Despite the tiny crack that made in the hard cement shell I'd built around my heart, I kept my teeth gritted together, my tone flat and unaffected. How sad for you.
I miss you,
he said again, backing me against the shop door. The cold of the glass and the remaining images of that horrible Victorian corpse dream were the only weapons I had to battle against the smoky comfort of his scent, the weight of his hands on my arms. I pushed him back, without any real heat. That's not really my problem. And you don't miss me. You're checking up on me because you don't trust me to take care of myself.
I miss you. I miss your laugh and your voice, and I even miss your insults.
He smiled, wistful, tracing the lines of my fingers with his own, up my arm to stroke the edge of my collarbone. Look, about opening night, I told him. You said some really hurtful things.
So did you,
he countered. Well, you're way better at them.
We can talk later. Right now, please, just admit it. You miss me,
he said, pressing me to the glass again, using exactly the right parts to do the pressing. I didn't answer, because frankly, I was doing very well to stay upright and clothed at this point. Bastard. As his mouth pressed ever so softly against mine, I forced my lips shut to keep from shouting that, yes, I missed him. Yes, having his hands on me made me feel more settled than I had in weeks. Yes, his grinding me against the door was absolute heaven, and if he did it slightly to the left, it would mean the end of a disturbingly long waking orgasm dry spell. Fortunately, Gabriel started biting my lips, which limited my speaking options even further. Gabriel's fingers stroked up my throat, trailing the tips along my jaw and into my hair. He ground his mouth down on mine, drinking in my groans as I pulled blindly at his lapels. This was just not fair.
Tell me, he demanded between kisses. Tell me you miss me.
I bit my lip. His brows drew together as I felt him slide what I call my sensible shopkeeper skirt over my hips. His fingers slid over my panties, drawing little circles against my skin through the damp material. His hand glided over my thighs to peel away my panties. He tucked them in his pocket.
Tell me,
he said again, pumping one and then two fingers inside me with aching slowness. My head slid back against the glass as my vision seemed to blur. Gah! He wasn't letting me think. If I was about anything, it was the thinking. His thumb glided over my oversensitive flesh, then plucked it like a guitar string, sending a thrumming wave along my nerve endings. I whimpered.
You can lie to me, Jane, but your body can't. I can feel how much you've missed me, how much you want me right now.
Keeping my eyes locked with his own, he brought his fingers to his lips and tasted me. He smiled.
Just as much as I want you.
My jaw dropped as I watched him lick his fingers clean. Screw thinking.
I miss you,
I whispered, hating myself as I felt his lips curve against my neck. I slid my hand between us and fumbled with Gabriel's belt buckle. Gabriel's own hand slipped along my rib cage, cupping my breast. He bent his head to press teasing little kisses over the thin fabric of my blouse before closing his mouth over my nipple. I dropped my bag so I could slip my hands around Gabriel's neck and pull him closer. The contents spilled around his feet as he cupped his hands under my butt and hitched me higher. His kiss was the center of my universe. Without it, I would go spinning off course into the dark, seeing nothing, feeling nothing. Through the haze in my head, I heard the faint slide of a zipper and locked my legs around his hips, crossing my ankles at the small of his back. I grabbed the lowest rung of the fire escape ladder for leverage as I began the long, slow slide onto him. I threw my head back, gasping, and nearly came right there. I let go of the ladder and twisted my hands in Gabriel's hair, yanking his head back, claiming his mouth with lips, fangs, and tongue. This was mine. He was mine. I clutched at his shoulders, arching my hips in time with his. A stream of promises, profanities, and pleas poured from Gabriel's mouth against my skin. I cupped the back of his head, cradling his face against mine. I closed my eyes, inhaled his scent, and smiled, even when his fangs extended and scraped lightly across my collarbone. If he kept doing that, keeping his mouth in sync with his movements, I howled and put my dizzying dream orgasms to shame. I writhed and convulsed around him, pulling him tight against me with all the strength I had. I may, at some point, have said some extremely dirty things in Portuguese. Gabriel was smiling, a big, goofy grin wreathing his face as he came, as if my muttering anatomically detailed instructions in foreign tongues was some sort of gift. And for some reason, that made me laugh, which resulted in some interesting aftershocks. Gabriel was triumphant.
"And to think you were this sweet, inexperienced librarian when I met you," he panted, pushing my hair out of my face. "Now look at you. You're a goddess. You can bring me to my knees with a word."
I blinked owlishly at him. Something about that sounded familiar and wrong. Something about Gabriel. The letters. In the letters, she'd said that Gabriel had enjoyed educating her from innocent to... Just as I was able to cobble a coherent thought together, Gabriel glanced down at the contents of my purse and dropped me on my barely covered butt. I would say it was undeserved, but I had just tased him.
"What is that?"
he demanded, pointing to the linen envelopes as I scrambled to my feet. "You dropped me," I pointed out.
"What the hell is that?"
"You dropped me," I repeated, "on my ass, just then. You may not have noticed, which I'm starting to think may be part of our problem as a couple." Gabriel dropped to his knees to look at the envelopes.
"Jane, answer me, what are these?"
"Letters," I told him, plucking the papers off the concrete before he could grab them.
"She's been writing to you?"
And there it was. Confirmation. My concerned friend wasn't just some crazy person with an affection for linen paper. She wasn't making up her connection to Gabriel. Gabriel knew who she was, and obviously he didn't want me getting information from her. I had two options here. Calmly and rationally discuss my feelings of confusion and abandonment and encourage Gabriel to enter couples counseling with me, or pitch a tantrum, demand information, and make a giant ass of myself. Any guesses about the route I chose?
"Excuse me," I seethed.
"But you don't get to breeze back into my life, after weeks without a word, pin me to a wall with your penis, and then demand answers."
"I'm not demanding answers, I just..."
"Who is she, Gabriel? Tell me what's going on. This would be so much easier if you would just let me in."
I can't tell you. What is she... Do you believe what she's saying?"
"I don't know what to believe, Gabriel. I mean, she's saying some things that sound pretty familiar." "Her scent is what drew you to her. It's what kept you close to her. That she was special. That you loved her. That you enjoyed her being so trainable and unpredictable, particularly in the sack. Do you know where I might have heard any of this before?"
"It's not what you think," he promised, edging away from me.
"What do you mean, it's not what I think? I don't know what to think, because you don't tell me anything. Look at me. This is the result of your grand freaking plan to protect me," I yelled. Gabriel started to turn away. I grabbed his arm and screamed, "Look at me!" Gabriel's face in the moonlight was a mask of misery, the shadows against his bone-white skin sharp and stark. I didn't have to be a mind reader to see that he wanted to disappear. "This is your handiwork, Gabriel. This neurotic mess of a vampire standing here. You made me what I am. I hope you're proud." Looking as if he'd been kicked in the gut, Gabriel backed away from me into the shadows. Hot, bloody tears spilled down my cheeks as I shouted, "Don't come back! Don't watch my house! Don't come by! Don't call me! Just stay away!" Gabriel's silver-gray eyes reflected back at me in the dark. I could hear his footsteps on the pavement as he walked briskly away from me without another word. Somehow, it seemed so much worse than the first time. I sank to my knees, crying until my eyes ran dry. I cried until I was embarrassed to be crouched in an alleyway, shedding tears for someone who obviously didn't care enough to shed them for me. I pulled myself together, grabbing my purse and straightening my rumpled clothes. "Damn it," I sniffled, looking around. "Where's my underwear?" I didn't want to be that friend who shows up at your door with raccoon eyes and hysterics complaining about her love life. That's why I didn't wear mascara. Andrea opened her door, wearing Dick's Virginia is for Lovers t-shirt and no pants, drinking a Budweiser from the can. A WrestleMania highlights DVD was playing in the background.
"Baby, who is it?"
Dick asked, coming out of the kitchen, wearing one of those beer-drinking helmets, jeans, and no shirt. "I take it back. You are not the same woman I met a year ago," I told Andrea. Andrea burped noiselessly under her breath.
"I'm aware."
"Everything okay, Stretch?"
Dick asked, taking off the helmet. He didn't, however, bother to turn down the wrestling match. Apparently, someone was about to shave Vince McMahon's head again. Andrea rolled her eyes at him and turned the TV off.
"What's going on, Jane?"
I tried to ignore the unsaid, "this time," that hung in the air. I opened my mouth, but I just couldn't find the words to express the mishmash of frustration and plain old mad I had spinning through my head. I moved my lips. I narrowed my eyes. I made angry hand gestures, but no words came out. I started to pace, gnawing my fingernails to the quick. Fortunately, they grew back almost instantly, which meant I had an endless supply. Andrea stopped me in my tracks by grabbing my shoulders.
"Okay, sweetheart. I'm all for nonverbal forms of communication, but you're starting to look like an extremely pissed-off mime. Use your words."
"I tased Gabriel," I blurted.
"Sweet,"
Dick shouted. Andrea shot him an annoyed look.
"Right. Sorry."
Dick tried to look remorse-stricken, but the minute Andrea's back was turned, he gave me an enthusiastic double thumbs up.
"What are you doing with a stun gun?" Andrea cried. "And how long have I been working in close proximity to you and said stun gun without my knowledge?"
I threw my hands up, exasperated.
"Why is everyone so surprised that I have a stun gun?" "Because I've seen you staple your hand to a purchase order," Andrea told me.
"Well, I can't return the damn thing now. I used it on Gabriel. Why can't I get a reaction on that?"
"Okay. Why did you zap Gabriel?"
Dick asked, his eyes gleaming.
"Don't be afraid to go into details."
"He snuck up behind me and I just zapped him. It was an accident. At first."
"That's my girl," Dick crowed.
"And then I had sex with him," I said, grimacing. "But just a little bit."
"I'll be in the kitchen," Dick said, beating a hasty retreat to another beer.
"And then he dropped me," I cried, burying my face in my hands. Andrea gasped.
"He broke up with you? Again?"
"No, he literally dropped me on my ass, on the concrete." Dick turned on his heel and flopped onto the couch.
"I can stay a little while."
Andrea gave him a silencing glare and patted my shoulder.
"So, you had a little accidental sex, big deal. It's like falling off the wagon. I'll just take away your 30-day Gabriel-free chip, okay? Wait, you didn't stun him again afterward, did you? Is that why he dropped you?"
"No. I dropped my purse, and a bunch of the creepy letters fell out. Gabriel saw them and asked if she was writing to me, which means that this isn't just some random crazy. This is someone from his past. Someone who sent him into some sort of Shirley MacLaine in terms of endearment-style panic at the idea of her communicating with me. And you know what pisses me off?" Andrea nodded.
"I've got some idea."
"He just runs off. Skulks away like some thief in the night. He gets me all riled up and angry, and then he leaves me all this crap to deal with no help from him. It's like a relationship hit and run."
I cleared my raw, aching throat and looked up into my friend's pitying eyes.
Andrea, I never thought to ask you directly because I just assumed you would tell me. But just in case you're trying to protect him or something, could you tell me, do you know who Janine is? I'm pretty sure she's my concerned and vigilant friend. The letters say that he made her, but maybe I'm being too literal. Or maybe she's just lying out her ass. Is it possible that she's Gabriel's sire? Because he won't share that story either.
Janine's not Gabriel's sire, Dick blurted out, clearly without thinking. And then, when Andrea and I turned our attention on him, he muttered, oh, crap.
Dick, who's Janine? Andrea asked.
Dick sighed, rubbing a hand over his face.
This is one of those, it's better if I keep my big mouth shut situations, honey.
Oh, damn it, Dick, I moaned. Not you, too. Andrea's lips pursed. She crawled onto his lap and made a pouty face. Dick groaned. We both knew he was powerless against Andrea's pouty face, or really any face that Andrea made.
Okay, fine. If you won't tell us who she is, tell us who she isn't.
How do you know Janine is not Gabriel's sire?
Because Gabriel's sire was a woman named Jessica,
Dick blurted out as if he'd been dosed with truth serum. He had the sense to look chagrined, but buckled when Andrea kissed his earlobe. He cleared his throat.
Irish gal, sort of snooty, and she was, is, not very nice. They met at a party hosted by my parents. I don't know how she found the party or how she chose Gabriel, but she led him away from the party into a cotton crib and had her lascivious way with him, and bit him. She didn't give him the choice. We didn't have the rules we do now. Back then, no vampire would say a word if you didn't necessarily wait for written permission to turn someone. Jessica thought Gabriel would be amusing, but she got bored waiting for him to rise. She had, well, has, a really short attention span. She walked off without thinking about what might happen if he was discovered or got hit with sunlight while he was still sleeping it off.
He was turned against his will?
I shuddered, imagining the torture such a violation would incur today. Eager to keep up a pleasant, harmless public image for vampires, the Council for the Equal Treatment of the Undead enforced strict laws against forcibly turning humans. The punishment included the trial, a combination of sunlight, silver, and sometimes a coffin full of bees, a veritable trifecta of capital punishment.
Well, it's more like she bit him and made him an offer he couldn't refuse, Dick said.
He caught up to her during World War II, feeding on orphans lodged in the English countryside. When he saw her again, when he saw what a monster she was, as much as he resented her abandonment, being left to figure out this vampire thing all by himself, he knew he probably would have grown cruel and bloodthirsty with Jessica. He was grateful that he was left alone. But he knows that his turning out so ass-numbingly dull was all a matter of chance. That's part of the reason he felt he had such a responsibility to you. He wants you to have the right sort of influence, to become all that you can be, and all that. Stretch, I've known Gabriel my whole life. For him to get this worked up over something, to put you through all this, he's got to have your best interests at heart. Just hold on for a while. Let him work it out for himself.
Whose side are you on? I grumbled.
Mine, he said.
If you two patch things up, I won't have to hear the pair of you whining all the damn time.
The pair of us?
I asked suspiciously.
You've been talking to him too?
Damn it, Dick!
We agreed we wouldn't speak to the enemy camp, Andrea yelled.
All I did was go over to his house and threaten to kick his ass on your behalf,
Dick said defensively. It was after the store opening, and when I saw how hurt you were, I couldn't stand it. I went over there and told him he was getting a beat down he deserved since 1878. And then he cried.
He cried? I asked.
Dick's teeth ground together, his expression disgusted.
Yes. He took all the fun out of it. How am I supposed to kick a man's ass when he's bawling like a baby? It was horrifying. I found myself comforting the jackass.
What did you tell him?
I asked. I told him that whatever he was going through, you were worth...
No!
No, I am not going to do this, Dick said, standing and waving the pair of us off. I don't want to get caught in the middle of all this. And Gabriel swore me to secrecy, which puts me right in the middle of this. Dang it, he's better than I thought.
He pulled his beer hat back into place and yelled,
I am Switzerland, do you hear me? Completely neutral. Work this stuff out yourselves. Now could everybody please be quiet so I can watch Macho Man Randy Savage beat the crap out of somebody?
But Dick! Andrea cried.
Shh!
Dick shot back, turning back to the wrestling match with a determined air. Andrea and I watched Dick with bemused expressions.
That's my boyfriend, Andrea said, sort of meekly.
At least yours didn't drop you on your ass, I pointed out.
Chapter 10. The best way to get over a messy breakup is to spend time with a supportive group of friends. The best way to chase off a supportive group of friends is to talk constantly about your messy breakup. Love Bites, A Female Vampire's Guide to Less Destructive Relationships. To say I had some pent-up anger would be like saying Britney Spears had minor impulse control issues. Love Bites encouraged me to channel those emotions in a positive direction, so I decided to pay Zeb's contractor a visit. The minute there was enough twilight shadow for me to move unscathed to the future site of Casa Lavelle, I ran through the trees at full speed. Zeb said that Buster, who was known for high-quality carpentry work before his interest in a perpetual buzz outstripped his desire for a growing clientele, took off at exactly 5 p.m. every day, leaving a pile of empty beer cans in his wake. The battered green, dowdy construction truck was parked in the shade of a huge elm tree where Jolene had talked about hanging a tire swing for the kids. Buster was dozing with his mouth open, his old faded Cardinals cap perched over his eyes. Long and lanky, he looked like a young Don Knotts, complete with droopy eyes and a twitchy lip. Somehow the construction site looked even more depressing than the last time I'd been there. The place was haunted by the ghost of supposed to be. Chalk outlines showing where the interior framework was supposed to be situated had long since faded into pale scribbles. Sitting in what was supposed to be the living room, a roll of insulation looked as if it was molding from exposure to the rain. Frayed plastic sheeting that was supposed to be protecting the framework flapped shroud-like in the breeze. It looked as if Buster unpacked his tools every day and did just enough to make it look as if he was working without making any actual progress. I stared at the sleeping Buster, my lip curled back. I let my fangs fully extend. This man had kept my friends dangling for months. He'd made Jolene cry. This was not going to be a happy meeting for him. With one lithe, soundless spring, I hopped onto the back of the truck and sat on the lip of the bed. I cleared my throat and hollered, Buster! Startling him into consciousness.
What?
He shouted, sitting up.
What's that?
Wake up, Buster. We need to talk.
Debbie?
He yawned, scratching his head and blinking in the low purpling light of the setting sun.
Honey, I told you. I'm sorry I said that about your sister.
Buster's eyes slowly came into focus, and he realized that I was not his angry live-in girlfriend.
Oh, hey, Jane,
he said, yawning again.
What's up?
We need to talk about your timeline for completing the house, Buster. I mean, walls painted, hardware on cabinets, light switches screwed into place, everything. What's your ETA? Buster cleared his throat and tried to use his professional voice.
Well, it's hard to say. So much of that depends on when I can get materials and extra guys out here to do some of the work. I'm just one person, you know.
Cut the crap, Buster. What month are you aiming for?
It's okay. The McLeans explained it all to me,
Buster said in a conspiratorial whisper.
They want Zeb and Jolene to give up on the house by the holidays. Jim McLean even promised me a bonus if I could get them to move back in with Jolene's parents before her due date.
I exhaled loudly through my nostrils.
One day, when Jolene's hormone levels were normal, we were going to have a long talk about her dad. The McLeans aren't bankrolling this project, I told him. I am.
That's not what Jim...
Gah! Buster yelped as I yanked him up by the collar and pulled him out of the truck and into the barely framed house. Still holding his shirt, I hoisted him against the strongest of the wooden ribs and pinned him by the throat. Normally, I would be nervous around this much exposed, fractured wood, but Buster was too frightened to think about staking me. Listen to me, Buster. Look at me. Really look at me. He spluttered and coughed, taking in the two bright eyes, the pale skin, the fading light glistening off long, sharp fangs. Yeah, I'm a vampire. I'm a vampire going through a really rough emotional transition. And Zeb and Jolene are among the few people in my life who don't piss me off right now, so I'd like to keep them happy. If that means checking up on you every day, beating the tar out of you to make sure you're sober and doing the work you promised, I'm going to do it. I dropped him to his feet and he promptly sank to the ground like a sack of potatoes.
But the McLeans...
The McLeans have told you it's in your best interest not to finish the house. Don't worry about that. Right now, I think you need to decide which of us scares you more.
I don't do the work that I used to do,
he mumbled, rubbing at his reddened throat. Because of the drinking? Well, consider me your own personal recovery program. The steps are, you build my friend's house on time and in good condition, and then you get to keep all of your limbs. Sound fair? Buster nodded, mute with fear. He sobered considerably as we went room to room in the shell of the house, discussing what would have to be redone, how long each phase should take. By the time I was ready to leave, Buster seemed almost excited about coming back the next day, or at least excited to keep all of his limbs. Bright and early tomorrow, Buster, I told him, and if Zeb or Jolene asks, we didn't have this conversation. Buster's smile was stiff, as if he couldn't remember how to be a people-pleaser and was working to recall the skill.
What conversation?
Eventually, Mama found the shop. The bad news was that Mama found the shop in time for the first meeting of the reconstituted chapter of the Friends and Family of the Undead. The good news was that seeing so many vampires gathered in one place freaked Emery out so badly that he found an excuse for leaving just a few minutes after he walked in. Maybe we could hold the monthly FOTU meetings every week. The FOTU used to meet at the Traveler's Bowl, a restaurant featuring healthy, global cuisine that spiraled into bankruptcy, not just because the owners tried to sell soy cheese to hollow residents, but because the police seized all of the glass sculptures they sold at the restaurant gift shop. It took Police Chief Don Parker several visits to recognize that they were bongs and not very complicated ashtrays. Unfortunately, it only took his son, DJ, one visit. Once you sell a bong to the offspring of a small-town police chief, it's a pretty safe bet that anyone who so much as pauses in your parking lot will be ticketed. With their handful of customers scared off, the owners had no choice but to close. The support group consisted of 20 or so people of all races, ages, and socioeconomic classes, all of whom were bonded through the shock of knowing that one, a loved one had died, and two, that loved one still walked around and sometimes had violent episodes. Plus, there's the embarrassment and stigma that can come with being associated with the undead in a small, rural town like the Hollow, where vampires still occasionally suffered household accidents involving pointy wooden objects. It helped new vampires and their families to be able to meet in a safe location just to talk or vent or learn that your newly turned son is not avoiding Sunday dinners because he doesn't love you anymore, but because you serve said dinners with the good silver, and he can no longer digest solid food. The group operated under guidelines that were a mishmash of Alcoholics Anonymous and PFLAG. We did not reveal our last names. Personal information revealed during the meetings was confidential. We were not required to disclose whether we were vampire or human. But after a few meetings, you figured out who was eating the snacks and who wasn't. The common ground was that each member hurt. Each offered understanding and sympathy to the other members. Each tried to keep a sense of humor. Zeb and Jolene actually met at a FOTU meeting.
Jolene was still recovering from the dusting of her recently turned childhood friend, and Zeb was still weirded out by my new dietary habits. Zeb brought me into the group a few months later. The meeting started out well enough. I'd set up complimentary drinks and snacks around the lounging area as a sort of welcome gesture. I'd even invited Cindy in the hopes of giving her some resources to deal with her awkward family situation. I gave her the usual latte, and she sat in the back, not attempting to socialize with anyone. All of the regulars I'd come to know were there, including Dee Dee, the de facto leader of the group. Dee Dee's banker husband was voluntarily turned in the midst of a midlife crisis. Instead of buying a sports car or having an affair, he decided he wanted to stop the aging process altogether. She'd felt pressured to be turned herself, aging a little every day while her husband remained forever 47. In the end, she had elected to remain human, and her husband left her. She was now dating a very nice accountant who fainted at the sight of blood. But she stuck around to help other people through the transition and welcomed new members to the group. And the newest addition to the group was my mother. Stupid grocery store community board. I turned my back for 2 seconds, and there was Mama, carrying a plate of brownies and wearing a black T-shirt with the Vampire Rights logo on it, and a name tag that she'd brought from home that said, "Hello, my name is Jane's Mama." Was it too late to change my name? I turned on my heel, hoping to escape the room, possibly get as far as Borneo, before I heard, "Janie, baby, it's Mama!" Cringing, I turned back to where Mama had Dee Dee in an arm lock and was dragging her over to me. "Now, Dee Dee, this is my daughter, Jane. She was turned last year. This is her shop. Isn't it wonderful? I'm just so proud," Mama cooed. "Jane, this is Dee Dee." "I know, Mama. I've known her for a while," I whispered. "Miss Dee Dee, would you please excuse us for a second?" Dee Dee winked at me and made her way to the bar to get a free latte. "I love your little shop, honey," Mama cooed, walking me around the lounge area like a show dog and mouthing a breathless hello to every person we bumped into. "I just love what you've done with it, the colors and the chairs and all the pretty little knickknacks. Did Andrea pick all this out?" "Nope, that would be me. I did this," I informed her. "Well, it's lovely, but I probably would have gone a little lighter on the wall color. You know, Jenny says if you paint a room too dark, it's like losing 10% of your square footage. You might have called her and asked her advice." "Well, since my lawyer has advised me against speaking to her without a transcriptionist present, that might have been difficult," I said, smiling sweetly. "Oh, now you're just being silly," she sighed, and then saw Jolene and Zeb come through the front door. Zeb saw Mama and turned on his heel, trying to usher Jolene out for a quick escape. But there was no escape. This was the Thunderdome of parental intrusion. "Zeb! Oh, honey, come see what Jane's done with the shop!" "Mama, he's seen it," I told her. "He's been here before. In fact, he helped me paint." "I appreciate that you're being so supportive, but could you be a little less, I don't know, forceful about it?" "I don't know what you mean." Mama sniffed and then launched herself at an unsuspecting Jolene for non-consensual belly rubbing. Andrea smirked at me. I glared at her. "Am I naked? Normally, when I have this dream, I look down and I'm naked." "I know. It's terrible. I'm sorry," Andrea said, barely able to control the twitching corners of her mouth. "You don't look sorry." "I'm terribly, terribly sorry," Andrea promised, a snicker escaping when she turned her back to fetch a bottle of hazelnut syrup. "You're just humoring me because I signed the checks, aren't you? I would say I don't need your pity, but obviously that's not true." Zeb joined me at the bar, having abandoned his wife to Mama's pregnancy interrogation, the coward. Zeb gave me a sympathetic shoulder squeeze. "I meant to tell you. Dee Dee put ads on bulletin boards in the supermarkets, Walmart, the events calendar, and the newspaper." I groaned. "I knew this community involvement thing was going to come back and bite me on the ass. You know what we could do instead? An awareness crusade for vampires who use sunless tanner. Nothing's as obvious as an orange vampire."
"It's good for business," Andrea told me.
She shot a fierce look at Zeb as she hefted a king-size tray of fruit, veggies, and cheese cubes.
I'm going to go rescue your wife with a plate of nutritious baby-building snacks, you weenie. Jane's mama doesn't scare me. She cleared her throat.
Much?
Zeb chuckled, watching as Andrea managed to insinuate herself between Mama and a grateful Jolene.
So how's the house coming along? I asked.
Zeb's face flushed with an incredulous smile.
Great. Buster actually started putting up interior framing this week. He's got a crew coming out to do the roof soon, and he said we might be ready for sheetrock before next month. And when Jolene's dad came out yesterday to give Buster the stink eye, Buster just kept his head down and worked his butt off. Even Lonnie had to admit that Buster was doing good, solid work. We might actually be moved in by Christmas. Can you believe it?
Wow, I intoned, trying to sound appropriately impressed. I kept my eyes wide and innocent. You must have really put your foot down with Buster.
Zeb puffed his chest out a bit and tried to sound nonchalant.
If I've learned anything from my scary in-laws, it's all about tone of voice.
As everybody circled to start the meeting, I scrambled to sit next to Mama so I could introduce her. Mama had apparently taken the time to memorize the pledge, a collection of 5 truths the group repeated before every meeting, and was louder than the rest of us combined as we promised, "I will remember that a newly turned vampire is the same person with new needs. I will remember that a loved one's being turned into a vampire does not reflect on me. I will remember to offer my vampire loved ones acceptance and love while maintaining healthy boundaries. I will remember that vampirism is not contagious unless blood is exchanged. I will remember that I am not alone."
Before Dee Dee could stand up to introduce herself, Mama bounced to her feet.
"Well, hello, everybody. I'm Jane's mama, Sherry. I'm just so happy to be here."
"Hi, Sherry," the group chorused, despite my attempts to pull Mama back into her seat by her sleeve.
"I'll admit that I went through a bit of a bad patch after Jane came out, but I've come to accept that I cannot change what Jane is," Mama said, her voice quavering, "and I need to do whatever I can to make her feel accepted and loved by her family, even if she tries to avoid spending time with us and isn't speaking to some of us."
"That's my Mama," I conceded.
"Well, Sherry, it's refreshing to see a parent so vocally supportive of her child after they come out," said Dee Dee.
I rolled my eyes. "Can we talk about the fact that her bad patch involved force-feeding me pot pie and trying to give me a tan?" I sulked through Dee Dee's discussion of the pain and confusion of new vampires adjusting to a human world, and through her pre-planned talk on subconscious conversational slips that can be highly insulting toward vampires. I couldn't help but think this last topic was directed toward Mama, and I was all for it. But she was so caught up taking notes and beaming beatifically at Dee Dee that I'm pretty sure the clue sailed right over her head. The group broke up to socialize, which was usually my favorite part of the meetings, but this time I was dodging my mother with a sudden, extremely urgent search for coffee filters in the stockroom.
"Jane? Gah!"
I cried, jumping and whacking my head on a shelving unit.
"Are you all right, hon?"
Mama asked, cooing over my new contusion.
"No, no, I'm not,"
I grumbled, rubbing my forehead.
"I'm sorry. I just wanted to catch you in private," she whispered. "I just wanted to see how you're doing, you know, since Gabriel broke up with you. Your daddy and Jolene said you took it awfully hard."
"Well, Gabriel did not break up with me. I broke up with him. And what is Jolene doing talking to you about that? If she thinks she can deflect belly questions by baiting you with information about me, well, that's just evil and brilliant, actually. I don't think I give her enough credit."
"Oh, you're so silly. Now, I'd like to talk to you about your grandma's birthday,"
Mama said breezily.
"Your Grandma Ruthie wants to make sure you apologize to Wilbur so we can all enjoy dinner without any unpleasantness."
Unpleasantness, like bringing up the fact that Wilbur tried to stake me with his cane the last time I saw him?" I asked. Mama made a disappointed face. Sometimes newly turned vampires are only given enough blood to enable them to wake from the death sleep. They have none of the vampiric strength or speed or charm. They're called ghouls. I only know this because my Grandma Ruthie almost married one of them earlier this year.
Despite the fact that Wilbur looked like Skeletor and may have bumped off several of his wives to sustain his endless after-death retirement, he and Grandma Ruthie decided to keep dating. After he tried to dust me with his cane. It turned out that Wilbur and Ruthie were a perfect match. After all, Grandma Ruthie's four husbands and previous fiancé all died under equally suspicious circumstances, involving a speeding milk truck, a brown recluse bite on the inside of the throat, a previously unknown allergy to Grandma Ruthie's famous strawberry rhubarb pie, a golf-related lightning strike, and a miscalculation of Viagra dosage. Wilbur and Grandma Ruthie seemed very happy together, though I guess when you never know when your lover might facilitate your release from your mortal coil, it's important to keep up the appearance of happiness. Frankly, I was glad they were still so lovey-dovey. For me to win the Deadpool with Zeb and Dick, either Wilbur or Grandma would have to meet a grisly end in a botulism outbreak next spring. No, absolutely not. You all can just celebrate without me, I told Mama. I do not apologize to people who try to kill me. It sets a bad precedent.
Oh, but your Grandma Ruthie will be so hurt if you don't show up, Mama protested.
No, she won't, I told Mama. You know she won't. She'll be much happier and things will be a lot less tense without me there. In fact, that will be my gift to her this year, not showing up. Mama looked resigned but unhappy, which was generally how we both felt when negotiating the logistics of family gatherings.
Sometimes I just don't understand the things that come out of your mouth, baby, Mama said, pushing my hair back from my face.
I hear that a lot, I told her. Mama chuckled, rolling her eyes.
Now that we have that out of the way, how are you doing, really?
Other than spending an unhealthy amount of time faking answers to magazine quizzes so I get better scores, I'm fine, I told her. The shop is doing well. I have sweet, patient friends with a high tolerance for whining. Zeb and Jolene keep me involved in their never-ending baby name debate. Dick is the older brother I never really asked for. Andrea wants to start a belly dancing class next month. My life is very full.
Do you want to talk about it? Mama asked.
No, I do not.
Honey, she sighed, tipping my chin toward her. I know it hurts right now, but whatever Gabriel did, I'm sure he's sorry. And if he's not, maybe Adam Morrow is still interested.
No, Mama. I love you. I love that you're being supportive and that you want to put me back up in the saddle. But trust me, you don't want me dating Gabriel or Adam. I'm better off alone right now. I kissed her cheek. But I love you.
I love you too, she said, squeezing my cheeks.
She let out a cleansing breath and returned to her normal, cheerful tone.
Maybe it would help if I invited Adam's mama to the meetings. You know, maybe if she learned to be a little more open-minded like me, it would make it easier on the two of you if you just happened to start dating.
I thought about making a smart comment, but for the sake of this newfound bridge of mother-daughter understanding, instead I said, maybe we shouldn't make more connections with a guy who has a fuzzy perception of personal boundaries.
Oh, you're so strange sometimes, Mama said in that tone of voice that always left me unsure of whether she was going to pay attention to what I said.
The gears in my brain whirred, searching for any activity that would keep Mama occupied and safely away from Adam Morrow's Mama. When all the machinery clicked into place, a wide smile spread over my face.
Mama, I said, putting my arm around her, how would you like to throw Jolene a baby shower?
I received a reminder email from Head Courtney that I had yet to submit a progress report on my collections for the prize committee. She was giving me 3 demerits and told me to meet with Jenny to better implement a synergistically creative approach to my begging freebies before a progress meeting with the Courtneys. I was going to find the person who sold Head Courtney her copy of Who Moved My Cheese and smack them. With an obvious expression of disdain, Jenny strolled through the shop's front door with her hand sanitizer at the ready. She seemed surprised by what she saw. She even smiled, just a tiny bit, at the fanciful little pottery dragon grinning at her from a table by the front window. How can I help you? I asked, smiling pleasantly to the point that it was hurting my face. We just got a shipment of self-help books.
Can I interest you in a copy of How to Stop Being a Raging Bitch in 30 Days?
Jenny's lip curled back, and I could practically see the acid response forming, but she bit her lip and exhaled loudly through her nose.
This is a nice place, she conceded. Good light, nicely arranged. Probably not a color scheme I would have chosen.
I'm sure. My teeth were grinding as I led her to the counter. I didn't offer her coffee or a scone, despite the fact that they were arranged temptingly under a nearby glass dome. This was not a social visit. This was business. Okay, fine, fine. Jenny had been making me feel unwelcome for years, and now I was having a tiny bit of revenge.
She smiled sweetly, or what passed for sweetly when you've had enough Botox to paralyze an elephant. Mr. Wainwright must have been fond of you to have left you all this.
Here we go, I muttered. Jenny shrugged, her eyes wide and not quite convincingly guileless.
I'm just saying, it must be awfully nice. You think I like the fact that Mr. Wainwright died?
I asked coldly.
Do you think I wouldn't rather he was here right now?
Technically, he was there at the moment, hovering over his favorite copy of From Fangs to Fairy Folk, Unusual Creatures of Midwestern North America, but I wasn't about to tell Jenny that.
I think I'll pop out to see how your Aunt Jetty's doing,
Mr. Wainwright whispered.
Coward, I muttered.
I turned back to my sister. Why did you come here, Jenny? Jenny tried and failed to look surprised by my line of questioning.
Courtney told you. We have to go over our collection plan before the meeting. I wanted to talk to you about getting some of the car dealerships in town to offer some detailing packages. I think I might have an in with the owner of Nelson Ford.
I searched Jenny's face. I even thought about peeking into her thoughts, but past experience with Grandma Ruthie had shown me that only prolonged the argument. It didn't help me win it. Fortunately, I'd known my sister long enough to discern the acquisitive, gleeful look in her eye when she was bordering on social triumph. And if she was really going to forge some sort of tenuous connection with the largest auto dealership in town, she would have been dancing some uptight little jig. My eyes narrowed. No, you didn't. We could have handled this whole thing by email. That's how we've done it so far. Why change now?
Fine. I want to talk to you about the house, Jenny said, sighing.
No!
I threw up my hands. My lawyer said I'm not supposed to talk to you about the house or its contents without him being present. That's why we've been handling this frustrating yet not at all rewarding task over email.
Jane, I think we can settle this without the lawyers.
How do you figure? Jenny actually had the good grace to look slightly timid, twisting her wedding band around her finger as she said,
Well, your situation has changed. You need to stay close to town now that you're running the shop. And besides, you don't need that big old place all by yourself.
If you finish that sentence, I'm going to punch you in the head.
Don't you threaten me, she said, shoving my shoulder. Don't you tell me what I need, I said, shoving her back, sending her chair scooting across the floor. Jane, you have so much stuff. I don't understand why you need everything the family's handed down. You're all alone. No one even sees all those beautiful things. They won't be appreciated in your house like they would be in mine.
I'm not having this discussion with you again, I told her, pushing back from the table.
Let's just get through this carnival from hell. I'll find a way to fake my death and escape from the chamber, and you can fight Head Courtney to the death for her position as queen of the evil hive. And then we never have to see each other again. You can pretend I died or something.
You did die, Jenny said, rolling her eyes.
So it should be easy for you. Why can't you just discuss this with me like a rational adult? She demanded.
Why? Are you going to behave like a rational adult? I shot back. She grunted and tossed her folder of chamber materials across the bar at me.
I can't talk to you when you're like this, which is all the time. I'm going.
She huffed and puffed while she slung her purse over her shoulder.
But this isn't over, Jane. You're going to have to deal with this sooner or later.
Jenny blew back out of the shop like a bitchy hurricane, leaving a trail of scattered prize committee papers in her wake. And when she'd tossed her folder at me, she'd knocked a huge stack of mail off the counter. Perfect.
I ran around the shop, picking up sheets of paper detailing Jenny's campaign to wheedle free floral arrangements and colonics out of the Hollow's business community. I also cursed a rather impressive blue streak that eventually began to rhyme and was soon coming out in iambic pentameter. Andrea had enrolled us in a poetry seminar. And when I finally managed to assemble the papers on the bar, I was confronted with the envelope. I'd been avoiding the mail for the past couple of days. Frankly, between the creepy Janine letters and my visa bill, the U.S. Postal Service wasn't exactly bearing me good news lately. But I couldn't ignore today's note, the creamy linen envelope stuck between humdrum bills and catalogs. I seriously considered tearing it up without reading it. Insight into my sire and his crazy possible ex's relationship didn't exactly make me happy. But the more I read, the more I wanted to know. Whoever this woman was, Janine knew exactly how much information to reveal, how much to play close to the vest to keep me confused, wound up, and coming back for more. She should have been a mystery author, or maybe run for Congress. I took a deep yoga breath and prepared myself for whatever obsessive looniness the letter had in store for me. And as I scanned the page, one word jumped out at me. Whore. I really hated it when people called me that.
I saw you. I saw you with him, rutting in an alley like some common whore. I warned you, but you wouldn't listen. What do I have to do to make you understand that you have to stay away from Gabriel? Do I have to do something drastic to get my point across? You have no one to blame but yourself now.
Oh. My hands trembled, and the letter fluttered to the counter. My stomach pitched, pushing the salty, sweet remnants of synthetic blood into my throat. The fact that someone had watched me engage in intimate acts in an alleyway seemed far more pressing than the fact that she was threatening to do something drastic. Personally, I thought the drive-by fruiting of my front porch was pretty drastic. But she'd seen us? Someone had watched Gabriel and me having sex behind the shop? She'd seen my sex faces? Heard the noises I made? Watched when Gabriel dropped me on my ass? I felt as if I'd been doused in ice water. What if she'd taken more pictures? What if she sent them to people I knew? Posted them on the internet? What if that's what she meant by having no one else to blame? I tried to imagine explaining nude online pictures to my mother. If she thought becoming a vampire was embarrassing, how would she react to accidental amateur porn star? I leaned my forehead against the counter.
Oh, not good.
What do you do in a situation like this? I certainly wasn't going to the police, who weren't exactly helpful in cases where vampires were concerned. I'd probably pressed Andrea's and Dick's nerves to the limit with my erotomania talk and the relationship hysterics. Zeb didn't need to be dragged into this, what with his procreative worries. That left one person, one man who would understand the situation, my feelings of paranoia and guilt and revulsion. And I wasn't talking to my sire at the moment. My computerized calendar alarm sounded from the register. Andrea had set it so I wouldn't conveniently forget my scheduled progress meeting. It was being held at Puerto Vallarta, the only restaurant in the Hollow that served Mexican food without a drive-through window. The theory was that the planning committee would build better connections and work more creatively in a social setting. Basically, it was an excuse for the Courtneys to get knee-walking drunk off half-priced margaritas on a weeknight. And because Nice Courtney wasn't a committee head, I wouldn't even have her as a social shield. Forced bonding time with inebriated Courtneys in a restaurant where I'm going to have to hide the fact that I don't eat. I groaned, flopping my head onto the counter. Peachy freaking keen. Chapter 11. If you're new to a relationship and your plans for the evening involve alcohol, consider this formula to determine your consumption. However many alcohol units it takes you to get you to start complaining about your last boyfriend, minus 100%. Love Bites, a female vampire's guide to less destructive relationships. I was, of course, the first person to show up at the restaurant because, silly me, I assumed that when a meeting starts at 7, that's when you're supposed to show up. The rest of the Courtneys and Jenny showed up at 7:20, just as a table for 10 became available in the crowded dining room. Apparently, I was the designated table saver. This was going to be a fun night. Puerto Vallarta